Park, we have a search experiment. And it's an international collaboration. And PICASSO stands for not for the painter, but for project in Canada to search for symmetric objects. And so these are the first belong to the collaboration. And I would like to start with the principle of detection. So how we detect, or we hope to detect, winds. So we have, the first thing is to talk about superheated liquids. So if you have a droplet of a superheated liquid and you have an incoming particle, just fine, you might deposit some amount of energy in a critical radius. And if this energy is above the minimum energy, so whatever happens, you can have a recoil, a nucleus recoiling inside of the particle itself, a nucleus, the nucleus recoils and deposits energy, or it can be like an alpha particle direct, the energy can be directly deposited. Or in any case, if this energy is deposited within, this minimum energy is deposited within a certain critical radius, this droplet, liquid droplet, undergoes a phase transition to a gas, to a bubble gas. And in the process, the droplet expands, when it becomes a bubble, it expands, and it emits a shock wave during the expansion. So you can detect the shock wave by placing piezo detector, piezo sensors, or transducers, on the walls of your detector. So that's the main idea. So this is the energy that has to be deposited within this minimum radius. It has to be larger than the minimal energy. And the radius, this minimal radius is determined by the thermodynamics and of the phase transition and the kind of liquids that you have there. So imagine that you have, so in this plot you have a particle here. And the particle starts depositing energy as time goes by. And you have this potential barrier. Once the energy, of course, always within the critical radius or the minimum radius, once the energy, this energy is deposited and this and is higher than, larger than this potential gap here, you have the phase transition. So note that this should be the boiling temperature. So the liquid is superheated when the liquid is at a temperature that's higher than the boiling temperature at that particular pressure. So when we talk about superheat, we're talking about two variables, pressure and temperature. Okay? So you can have the same superheated state by keeping the, by having different pairs of pressure and temperature. Okay? And the energy that you have to deposit is always the same for if the pair gives you the same superheat. Okay, so that's the variables that are in these equations here. So you see depend on the surface tension and the conversion efficiency. All right. What I want you to take home is that why do you use this technique? What are the main advantages? Well, the first one is that if you choose your superheated liquid carefully, you can work it at room temperature. And the second thing is this process is insensitive to MIPS. Because MIPS are not able, in the operating temperature range, they are not able to deposit enough energy within the minimum radius. So we are insensitive to better than up to 10 to 10 at the operating temperature. We're going to see that when you go to higher superheated states, we are sensitive to mix, but we don't go there. That's what we can choose. So there are at least three experiments that use this technique. One is simple in Europe, two in the United States, and Picasso. Okay, how do our detectors look like? So basically, we have a container with the gel, apple gel matrix. This is the inert part of the detector. And dispersed in this gel, we have this droplets of freon. In our case, it's C4F10. And this is the active component. So it's important to know what's inside our detector so you can zoom in. And so easier said than done, because we have to do this for the whole volume of the detector. And right now, the only way of doing that is destroying the detector. Why you do that? Because you want to know this. The droplet size distribution. It's very important to understand the response of the detector. So, and it's also important. It's important to understand the response of the detector. And we want to have this distribution. Well, ideally, we would have only one droplet size in the whole volume of, like here, this is a cartoon, of course, and you see only one droplet size. This would be the ideal situation. In reality, that's what doesn't happen. We have a distribution like this. And we have improved our fabrication processes to get a sharper distribution, a big in a certain region. You're going to see when it translates to a volume distribution, it takes around 200 microns. So the size is varied from, let's say, 20 to 300 microns. And we'd be happy if we could have all droplets around 200 microns. Okay, so this is done. So we analyze, we have to slice the gel, take pictures, imaging, get the sizes, and then get to this droplet distribution. So the fabrication is based on a commercial bubble detector that's a neutron dosimeter and is made by this bubble technology. And this is our industrial partner, as you might have seen. And we modified and customized this detector that are very tiny. It's this kind of detector machine. So this is a very small, like in a vial. And this actually was our first generation of detector. You see the piezo sensor here. So with this you can buy. It's commercially available. So it's a neutron dosimeter. But what we did, we improved the fabrication techniques to customize to our needs. That are, we need larger detector, of course, we need active mass. And you need cleaner detectors. So to mitigate backups. So this detector actually, the commercially available ones are kind of dirty, so not really suitable for that kind of research. So there's a huge effort in the collaboration to develop techniques to clean this purified ingredients that go into the detector. It's still one of our major roles is to purify detectors to get lower backgrounds. Okay. So this is something that was developed by the collaboration for 3 years. And the ingredients for our standard gel are water, acrylamide, so these are things that we introduce for the gel to polymerize. Because once the fabricated detectors, we don't want the droplets to move around. But on the other hand, we don't want to squish them. So we need a polymer that polymerizes and keeps the droplets in place in a way that we can operate the detectors. So I'm going to show you how it works. So in this process, the main source of backgrounds of a particle as cesium chloride. We have to introduce the salt, that's a heavy salt, because the freon is very dense, it's 1.6. And to equalize densities, we have to introduce the salt, otherwise the droplets would sink during the fabrication process. So it's a good thing, we equalize the densities, we can have the droplets homogeneously distributed inside the detector. And the price to pay that is that we introduce methanol. So I want you to see that we are moving on from this technique, and we are looking at a new one that we don't have to use this heavy salt. And this is the salt, what we call the saltless detector. That here we use glycol and glycerin, and the idea is that use the viscosity of these two ingredients to prevent the droplets from moving while the polymerization is happening. So once the detector is polymerized, nothing moves anymore. Okay, so the main everything is started with this paper, where the idea of using this kind of detectors for dark matter research was introduced. So this is actually the PI for the collaboration. Okay, so inside the detector, each droplet behaves as an independent bubble chamber. And so they work in principle independently. So you have millions of droplets inside the detector, and each one of them is a bubble chamber. So we have KeV threshold for dark matter induced recoils, and a full efficiency, and we can operate the detectors up to 40 hours, and we're going to discuss that in a sec. And the detectors can be recycled. That's what I'm going to show next. And it's a low cost, and everything is done by the collaboration. Application, sinks, the containers. So this is the evolution of our fabrication and our experiment. We started like this with commercial detectors, then we developed this 180 detectors. This with the help of the Snow collaboration, because the Snow collaboration housed us for many years. And this is actually part of the plumbing system for the water system at Snow. So we got some of this plastic, and it was donated to us, and because it's very clean. It's polypropylene, and we made many detectors out of this pipes. So that was our second generation, and that was what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to show the results that came out of this, the phase we used the detector. And after that, we developed this larger detector, 4.5 liters, third generation, as the one that we are presently operating. Okay. So, imagine that you have our detector here again. This is droplet size is the same everywhere, but that's not, in reality, it's not like this. And so, how do we start our data taking? So, first of all, you pressurize the detectors, you turn them off. Because remember, superheat depends on the pressure and temperature. If you apply high pressure to the detector, the superheat state goes really low. So nothing happens. The droplets are not sensitive. And we are talking about 90 to 120 psi, or 8 bars. Okay, so the detectors in this state are off. So when you start the data taking, we remove the pressure. So the detectors are on, ready to taking data already. So if a particle comes, interacts with a droplet, the droplet becomes a gas bubble, and you see the short wave, so is received by these two piezo sensors, and if this signal is sent to the data position, so it becomes an event. So this was done at certain temperature. So we stay in the state taking data for approximately 40 hours. So after the 40 hours, this bubble continues to grow. It starts, the first burst, the size, the ratio between droplet size, bubble size is 5 in diameter. So we mean about 100 times larger in volume. But it keeps growing. If you leave it there for a long time, and that's what makes us to have to stop the data taking, it may damage the gel. So we established that 40 hours, if you imagine that the first event occurred right after the pressure was released. So 40 hours is safe. So after 40 hours, you have to turn off the detectors again. But it's not only that. When you apply the pressure, that gas bubble becomes a droplet again. So we have a recycle, of course, at many events. Hopefully not, but because of macros, we have many events. So we have many gas bubbles. So, but when you apply pressure again, you turn off the detector, but more than that, you recycle the detector. So the detector is new. It's brand new again. So to have the droplet with the gas bubble to be recompressed completely to a gas, to a liquid, we leave the detector compressed for approximately 10 to 15 hours. And with all these parameters, we are improving because we're continuously assessing the efficiency of this value's parameters. So we leave the detector like this for 15 hours. And then during this time, we can change the temperature. Because when you change the temperature, we change the superheat state of the detector. And in doing this, we change our sensitivity to background and to signal. And this helps us to understand the background. So we're going to see how we do that. So, and then we start all over again. So we stay again. So that's this data tank cycle. And our utility cycles are approximately 75%. But that's all we have to do. So we can operate these detectors for years. It's proven that we operate that for years. Okay. How we make the detectors? So first we need ultra pure water. We have this purification reverse osmosis system. We need a clean room, and you need to purify all ingredients. So I have this thing of matching densities here. So the gas, the C4F10, is added in liquid form. The fabrication procedure happens at very low temperatures, actually at minus 70 degrees, because at this temperatures, the superheat is very low again, and there will be no phase transition. So we steer the monomer with the freon, and then in the end it polymerizes, and you have our detector done. So we assess the amount of C4F10 of freon that we put inside the detector. That's very important because that's our active mass. And this is this is a table that shows different detectors how much active mass was put in. And this the calibration that you perform right after fabrication to check if the active mass is really there. So we have this curve here. It shows that it goes really well. You can really trust that this active mass is all there. Okay, now why we use it for F10? So actually we are after the fluorine. Because waves can interact with ordinary matter in basically two ways, spin dependent and spin independent. So if you want to see the interaction, the spin independent sector, you want to use heavy nuclei, okay? Because the interaction, the enhancement factor here goes with the square of the mass. But in the spin dependent sector, it goes with this factor here. And fluorine has the highest value. So that's why we use fluorine, because it gives us the highest enhancement factor. So, and C4F10 has a large amount of proportional amount of fluorine. So it's an ideal freedom to use, and besides, it can be operated at room temperatures. So that's why we use this freedom. So we are targeting the spin-dependent sector of the wind-matter interaction. Okay, one important thing is to determine the threshold of the detector. Our detector is a threshold detector, so it detects everything above a certain energy. And for that, we use an accelerator. So we have a proton beam. We have a proton beam. We have a target, and this proton, and then from that we create a neutron beam. And we use this, the target is lithium. We started with lithium. So we can determine the recoil efficiency, we can control the active matter we showed. And we can compare different liquids, because they're not stuck with C4F10, and we might decide to use another liquid with heavier nuclei as target, for instance, and explore the spin independent as well. But for now, we're happy with the spin independent. So we can calibrate the detectors with this neutron beam. So here you have the thresholds for the triggering of the events. So you see a comparison between the cross sections of neutron and fluorine and neutron and carbon. And you see here that carbon is flat, and you have all the spikes in the fluorine cross section of these resonances. Okay, so we use this equation, of course, to determine from the energy of the neutron, you can determine the recoil energy, of course, it's the angle of the interaction. And if you do that, you determine the maximum energy that you can have at certain neutron beam energy, and you can determine the thresholds. What you do, you put your detector in front of the beam at a certain fixed energy, or fixed temperature in the case here. So we have a fixed superheat state. And you vary the energy of the beam until you start seeing events. And that's what we would expect, and that's the beam. Okay, so you do that at various temperatures. So you determine the threshold to a certain energy, a neutral energy for various temperatures. And you can, this is why we are using, we started with lithium, then we use vanadium, because of the energy that we can reach. So if vanadium is heavier, so we can go to lower threshold, get lower energy in the neutral beam. So, and of course, take advantage of the resonances here. And this is for the lithium, it's much higher. So we can explore energy from 5 keV to 5 MeV. Okay, and in the end, you get this. As I said, you have your fixed energy for the beam, and then you vary the temperature, and you start seeing data, so we can start seeing events, so you determine your threshold. And you do that for many beam energies. So very high means that at a very low temperature, you start seeing events, and at higher temperatures, the thresholds, or the trigger happens at lower neutron beam energies. Okay? All right, then you can invert that, and you can get the neutron minimal energy, KV, as a function of the temperature. And of course, temperature and pressure. So you do this exercise varying temperature at fixed pressure. So this characterizes the response of the detector. And why we use neutrons? Of course, because neutrons mimic the wind interactions. We cannot distinguish those. So doing this, we're calibrating the detector for the wind search. And you can determine also the efficiency. Temperature, you translate the beam energy and recoil energy, and you can have this efficiency curve. You see that at 50 degrees Celsius at the where is it? Pressure? This should be ambient pressure, like 1 bar. And you have your detector fully efficient at requires around 10 AED or less. Very well, so this plot shows how our sensitivity to different kinds of particles. So see, these are the recoils, that's what we are interested, but background. Not necessarily waves, but with neutrons as well, but wave is in this region here. And you have the start, the onset of the emit sensitivity, and you have this form limit where everything falls apart. Well, now it's not. So we don't want to get there. Okay, so we compare our this results, this measurements with the beam with Monte Carlo simulations. So we have temperature, and this is the count rate. Sorry, some of the words are in French, but this is the count rate. And so this is the Monte Carlo in yellow, and our data. And the same, so this is done at the test beam. So these are calibrations and Monte Carlo for the test beam. But they also have calibrations in the mine with a neutron source, with this, of course, this is spectrum here. And for different detectors, and that's our Monte Carlo, and that's our. And the at threshold, it's we don't, for neutrons, we don't have a step function. But we don't even have a threshold like this. Okay, so this is F threshold. The very at this point here is not a step function. Okay, so this is I'll come back to this plot. So this is where things go bad with MIPS. It's around this temperature here. And it's around 50 degrees, about 50 degrees, you start seeing delta electrons. This is the gamma response. So we should be sensitive to gammas. We are below this temperatures here. This is for ambient pressure. And from here on, we start being sensitive to gamma. So what we do, we don't get there in our data taking, operations, because we know that we're going to have more data. So we take data at lower temperatures. And then you have the limit of stability of the gel or the field, that at temperatures above this value here, the thermal fluctuations in the field itself are enough to trigger phase transition. So we also don't want to get there. Okay, so for the dark matter research, we know the recoil spectrum of the dark matter. We know the efficiency of the detector. We convolve with the count rate, depends on the mass of the neutrino, the cross section, and everything. And we get the neutrino response for our detectors. So this comes from the virtual calibrations that I have just showed. So in the mind, you have calibration, but just to check the performance of the detector. To determine all the same to use the beam, the neutron beam. Okay, why do you take data at different temperatures? Because we know that our background, the response of the detector to the background varies with temperature. And the response to neutrinos varies with temperature as well. So, to determine this curve, what we do, we spike the detectors with an alpha emitter. So during the fabrication process, we contaminate on purpose the detector, so we have a lot of alpha events. And from that, we can determine the background curve as a function of the temperature. And when you do that underground, I'll get there, actually we can we know what happens with the background. So we can fit our data with signal plus the expected background, and that's how we get our limits. Okay, of course, to get rid of most of cosmic ray induced background, we go underground, and we choose to go in snow. So we started taking data there in 2002, the first phase of the experiment with little detectors. Snow lab didn't exist at that time. It was only snow. So it was one experiment, one cavity for one experiment. And they graciously allotted us some space. And we could have our setup there. So 2 kilometers underground. So this is the what the snow was in brown here. Picasso has it set up. Right. And this is the expansion, the new snow lab. I just want to talk about that later. And this was our setup up, until 2005. So it's a small setup. These are water cubes. And open, you have this two of this. This is a temperature control system. So you put the detectors inside to vary the temperature. And you compress the detectors. At this point, you use nitrogen to compress the detector. But we learned that nitrogen introduces bubbling, and it dissolves in the gas in the gel, and introduces spurious events. So we stopped doing that. So this is the response of the detector to various neutrinos, and this is the detector. And you got for 3 detectors that we used. This is the background curve. This is the data. This is the fitted background. And we fit the signal, and we get the explosion limits. So fluorine has an unpaired proton, so the neutron interaction is not very good. But when we published the results, we were alone here. But then NIAID came right up. OK, so this is the APAN plot. So what we're doing now? We improved our fabrication process. We have larger detectors. Now we have 32 modules like this, 4.5 liters, for a total of 2.2 kilos of C4FM. It's about 1.7 kilos of fluorine. That's what matters to us. We have 288 channels, acoustic channels, and a compressor with mineral arc. So another improvement was the purification. We use a new method of new ingredients to a new product to purify the detectors. So we can get better results. So this was improvement. And also, we developed the saltless detector where we get rid of the main source of contamination, that's the cesium chloride salt. We improved also the way we could fabricate the detectors, so we have not. So this is a node for 1 liter detector's droplet distribution. Now for the 4.5 liters distribution. So we have a higher loading, meaning that we can put more active mass per liter inside the detectors. And we do localization of events because we have 9 transducers around the detector walls. So we can determine the position of the events. We look for hot spots, weird things that can happen. This is our, so we have 2 kilometers in the ground. Cosmic ray background is negligible to us, but there is a background due to the cavern, the thorium and other nuclei on the walls of the cavern. So we have this Monte Carlo that shows how much we have, what the flux is, and it's, right now it's 100 times lower than our sensitivity, so we're fine with that. So this cubic foot water boxes that are enough as a water shoot for now. So this is the, in 2006, that was the status of the new setup. That's the new setup, how it is right now. This is the pressure system, our preamps, 9 channels here, and that's how it looks like inside of the PCS now. 4 detectors, this is a temperature pressure control system, so we can vary pressure and temperature there. And we have 8 of these boxes for a total of 4 detectors inside of each, total of 32 detectors. So this again. Okay, this is how the detector, so this is a new saltless that is slowly being introduced. This is calibration sources that we put there to calibrate the detectors on site. And again, another feature. And then how we see the events. We treat the events at a high-pass filter. Then we do some analysis, some filtering and analysis of the signal. We rectify, we integrate to get the power. And then we have FFT analysis. And determine where the signal should be. The signal should be compared to the background. Because we have, besides alpha neutrons, we have spurious analysis that have contaminated our data. Picasso is the mine is active, so there are blasts. So we have to, sometimes we have strange events, so we have to take care of all of those. And so that's what we do. We have this determination of this variable, so we can separate what's not. And we have these regions. We don't discriminate between alphas and neutrons here. I'll show you how we do that. So this is the response of the new detectors. So alpha background, neutrons, neutrinos, and the bits. And this is the response of two detectors that we have been analyzing, or that we have analyzed the data. And we are about to publish the data from these two detectors. And so this is analysis of our systematics. And we almost have new results, but not today. I can show you only our sensitivity for the results that we're about to publish. So this should happen in July, probably a talk, 2009. We're going to present the results. And today I can show you more than that we're here.
What does it mean that it's flat? I mean that
because we don't want to show the shape of the curve.
That's where the table is.
It's just the middle. And because we're still rechecking and rechecking our system. The paper is ready, sitting on the desk. It's just because we're rechecking the systematic. And because there are some issues here, we can make some statements about this region. So we're being very careful. So, but I'm sure that at top, we'll be able to present the real results. This just gives you. Note that if you see this is our 2005 results, you see that we have a high sensitivity at lower masses, and it's kind of interesting to have it now. So that's why I'm not showing it today. So it's embargoed. So that's why.
So once it's in the shaded region, how many events do you expect?
I cannot show you that. So, 2009. Okay, the last thing I want to talk about is something that we discover in our events, is that we can statistically discriminate between alpha background and neutrons from calibrations. So you see, we look at the amplitude of the events, so we receive the events, there is a certain amplitude, voltage, because of the sound wave that hits the piezo. So we have this amplitude, and consistently, alpha-induced events have a higher amplitude than neutron-induced events. So we can use this tool to discriminate between alphas and neutrons. So this was published last year in the New Journal of Physics. So this is going to be being implemented in our data analysis. So why is that? So the explanation for the fact that alphas have a higher amplitude, a larger amplitude than neutron-induced events, and consequently, well, this is between background discrimination. So it discriminates against alphas and neutrons, it means alphas and WIMPs as well, because we kind of control well our neutron background at this level of sensitivity. Our real problem is the internal background due to alphas. So, it's because there are nucleation sites when you have a neutron, it hits a nucleus recoils, it creates only one DDX, such that it creates only one nucleation site. Now, for alpha particles, depending on the temperature, it's a continuous deposition, so you have many nucleation sites. So this happens in the very beginning of the signal. And if you have more nucleation sites, and because these bubbles are proto-bubbles, they coalesce, so this is inside of the liquid droplets, So they coalesce, and then they coalesce. When they coalesce, they emit sound waves. It's before the bubble expands as a whole. And this can be, so there's more power involved here. And that's why alphas have more power in the final amplitude. So this varies with temperature. We have problems with the gain of the preamplifier because of saturation, so we're changing that because we want to see separation like here, that's very good. Now it's not good. So here it's very bad because alphas and betas basically both have one temperature is very low, superheat is very low, one occlusion site for more kind of interaction. But as the temperature goes up, superheat state is higher, so alpha should make more occlusion sites. But then if you have saturations, if your amplitude is too high, it saturates, so you don't see the discrimination anymore. So that's what we're working on right now. Okay, my conclusions. So this is just a theory behind what we're doing and our timeline and milestones. We are actually taking data here in the mine. So the idea is to go to the next stage of 35 fields. And finally, my conclusions. So 32 detectors running in the mine. So we have better traffic. We have this discrimination. So results 2009 in July. Next month. And so we're preparing for the next phase. Thank you very much.
We have time for a quick question.
Maybe a dumb question. You're saying about this shockwave that is formed. Now, when you say about this 32 detectors, does it mean you have one piezo detector for each one of them, or how many measurements do you make?
You have 90 piezos for each one of them. So we have 288 channels. So each detector has 9 acoustic channels. Mm-hmm. And usually, when we have a good event, a particle induced event, all 9 piezos see or hear that event. Mm-hmm. Sure.
No matter how many.
We have trigger multiplicity. So if less than 4 piezos trigger, we don't consider the event.
All right. Now, and then the second question is the sensitivity versus detector size. Now you're going for now 30 liter. And what does that mean? As you increase this, how much improvement do you
have? The sensitivity comes really from the measurements. When you increase in volume, you get more active mass, so you have more exposure.
Right.
But
this is the
bulk, you have more mass, you have more target.
Right.
So it's a combination, because you see here that you are working the purification as well. Okay, it doesn't help to have a larger detector, mm-hmm. more active mass if your backgrounds are still the same.
Yeah. So you are still being limited by the background.
We are limited by the alpha backgrounds right now. For the next phase, mm-hmm. if you reduce the background, we'll be limited by neutron backgrounds as well. So we have to redesign our shielding. Our water shielding around the setup, because in our setup, this is the water shield, the cubic foot water boxes. So they surround the whole setup. So inside you see these guys here, see the box, so the detectors inside those boxes.
Okay, so I think in the interest of time, we'll just have questions. There's one question we're going to ask after the talk. Okay. One second. Here we go.